down shortly here, and H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. It is Saturday, the 21st of October in the glorious future year of 2023, and I am coming to you by pre-recording, although I may be live online in the SDF comm chat. I got the nasal splints out, so I'm breathing a good deal more freely and my voice should sound more or less normal, but I'm still not entirely on form. I thought about going to the State Fair of Texas today, but I don't think that I feel good out and about in the crowds, even with a mask with, you know, surgical wounds in the nose. So, the question I'm sure everyone is waiting with bated breath to hear from last week. I have indeed seen the rarest of all astronomical phenomena, the crescent sun, which only appears when the sun turns its dark night side toward the Earth. And yes, that was a joke about Pythagorean central fire astronomy, which only like 4 people in the entire English-speaking world will get. But hey, you knew what you were getting into when you tuned into this program, probably. Yesterday I went to the post office, and much to my gratification, in addition to a World Postcard Day postcard from SDFer Christy O'Twisty in the suburbs of Vancouver, British Columbia, hi Christy, there was a mailing tube from the International Atomic Energy Agency. I had written away some months ago for the annual posters published by the Power Reactor Information System, which give a snapshot of nuclear power in the world, and I wondered if they'd lost my request or something, but they did show up. Great thanks to Ms. Marta M. Gospodarczyk, Scientific Secretary to the PRIS in Vienna. And I'll try to get a photograph of those for the post on and on radio that goes with this show, although I may not be able to put up right away. Still no progress on getting my power reactor charts back from Albuquerque, though. Clearly I need to contact some folks at the University of New Mexico Library and at Sandia to find out who has them. Thanks to Hugh Mayfield for signing up for the Man and Atom Patreon campaign at the rate of 120 Czech crowns a month. Thanks also to Tobe for a letter enclosing a Xerox out of Abby Hoffman's Steal This Book with a variety of more or less unlikely coin substitutions. Low-value foreign coins which could be used to slug U.S. vending machines. One of the underlying problems of that approach is, of course, that most of these coins, aside from having to get them from their country of origin to the United States, were produced in very, very small quantities compared to U.S. coins. For Icelandic coins, for example, a typical press run might be 50,000, whereas the U.S. denomination you're trying to substitute for was probably produced 100 million or more a year for many years. Something I've been thinking about recently is that human beings have a tendency to see and understand the world by way of stories and narratives. Even people who are enthusiastic about facts construct narratives. The question is merely whether the facts are decorations on the narrative or whether they give structure to the narrative. And in this sense, we are very unfortunate, I think, because nuclear energy falls very, very easily into the story mode known as Eldritch Horror, which has been something of a favorite in the past 100 years or so. It's noteworthy for having effects without visible cause. You take a nuclear fuel bundle. You put it into a reactor. It remains there for 3 to 5 years, generates as much heat as tens of thousands of tons of coal, but there's no visible cause for that heat. You know, burning tens of thousands of tons of coal, you have this mountain of material which is turned into a mountain of ash and vast quantities of smoke. You can see that something's happening. You take the fuel bundle out of the nuclear reactor, and it looks exactly the same as it did when you put it in. Except, of course, that you have to view it through a meter of leaded glass, because if you were to stand next to it for any length of time, some weeks later you would die horribly, which is another effect without a visible cause. And of course, if you immerse that spent fuel bundle into a pool of water, it becomes surrounded by a ghostly blue glow, which could have been taken right out of the handbook of horror art. And then, of course, we have the other minor aspects of nuclear science, such as the ability to see into and through flesh, to see what's inside the human body, or the ability to track objects and substances from a distance without leaving any sign that they have become uniquely and horribly visible, as Tolkien's phrase was, for the effect of putting on the One Ring while within the borders of Mordor. So there's a challenge to you. If the characteristics of atomic energy are such that it really plays into the kinds of narrative forms and structures that people associate with the powers of darkness and matters man was not meant to meddle in, and so on, how do we turn that around? How do we tell other stories, better stories, stories which really reflect hope, stories which reflect the fact that atomic energy is one of the safer of industrial endeavors, certainly, but more importantly, reflect the hope that comes with the ability it gives us to transform our world? Because that is fundamentally what energy is, the ability to transform the world. And of course, atomic energy, being so vast and so concentrated, gives us the ability to transform the world for good or ill. We can make hundreds of cities into blasted wastes in the space of an hour or two. Or we can fulfill dreams of peace and prosperity. And this brings me to a very important point that follows from what I had to say last week. I take it as a key point of practical morality that the onus, right, the burden of making the world better, the burden of avoiding conflict, whatever burden it is that arises in a particular situation, falls, as between parties, principally on the party with more power to do something about it. And so, in the narrow context of the conflict in Palestine, you have one party which has tanks and jet aircraft and, in the last resort, atomic bombs. Obviously, the party which has these things has more power to change the world in ways which alleviate the pressures that cause conflict, in ways which move away from conflict, than parties which don't have those things. And therefore, whatever the abstract justice of the situation, whoever is in the right or in the wrong in the abstract sense, the one who has the ability to do something about it is the one on whom the onus rests to do something about it. Hamas says that as a matter of abstract justice, Israel must be wiped from the face of the earth, and no Jew can be allowed to live between the Jordan and the sea. The Jewish Home Party, on the other hand, and other ultra-radical, fanatical religious Zionists say, God gave us this land. No one other than Jews can be allowed to live between the Jordan and the sea. That's their idea of abstract justice. And I say, to hell with both your ideas of abstract justice. There was a British government report in the 1930s which warned that it seemed impossible, based on land and water resources and similar considerations, to establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine, which was something that the British had promised to do when they took on Palestine as a League of Nations mandate at the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. This report was, it's fair to say, not welcomed, because it appeared after Hitler had already stripped the rights of nationality from German Jews, and European Jews were trying to flee to other countries and being turned back, in particular German Jews, because Hitler wouldn't let them leave the country with any money. And so, in addition to the general fact that Jewish immigrants were often regarded as undesirables, German Jews with no money to their name were considered indigent, public charges, and therefore especially undesirable. So there was a burning need to establish some kind of safe haven for Jews who were being expelled from other countries, persecuted in other countries. But the British mandatory authorities said, well, despite the fact that large numbers of Jews have already immigrated to Palestine, it can't be in Palestine, because in order to do that, you'd have to push out the people who are already living here. In effect, genocide, although that word wasn't used in those days. Basically, they said, if the Jews are going to come here, the people who are already here would have to go somewhere else, and as the mandatory power, we're responsible for their welfare, and we can't allow that to happen. Now, I'm not going to say all this was foreordained. It is true that the Israelis have increased the agricultural productivity of the country to an extent, which allows more people to live there. It's also true that Israel has made itself something of a center for relatively high technology industry, thus further increasing the productivity of the country and allowing more people to live there. But it shouldn't be forgotten that for many, many years, the state of Israel wasn't anything like self-supporting. It relied on Jews living overseas buying Israeli bonds, which were denominated in a continually depreciating currency, so that they would never get back anything like what they invested. But by doing so, they bought security for themselves and their families and their communities. And I'm not talking here of that which I do not know. My grandfather worked for a number of years for a jeweler in Dallas, of whom it was jokingly said that he was a line item in Israel's budget. He bought lots of Israeli bonds. He had photographs on the wall of his office of himself with various Israeli politicians and generals and so on. And he knew perfectly well that he wasn't going to get back the money that he sank into those bonds, but he was a Polish Jew. The community he came from didn't exist anymore. So the question we have to ask is, can a strong Jewish state exist in Palestine? Because at this point there's no place else for it, without getting rid of the people whose parents, grandparents, and so on were in Palestine before the large waves of Zionist immigration. Is it possible? Can it be done? Or are we left, by the logic of the modern nation state, with a situation in which the only way to protect against, prevent one genocide, is to commit a different genocide? Because I guarantee you, most of the people inside or outside Palestine who are involved with what is, very plainly, and has been for generations, a genocide against the Palestinian people, don't actually want to be involved in a genocide. Again, the Jewish Home Party and their friends are an exception. And some of the radical Palestinian factions are an exception. They may differ on what genocide they want to be involved in, but they definitely want to be in one. The majority of people, however, just don't see any other way out of the situation they're in. Is it possible to find another way out? Now, of course, I tend to believe that it is. I'm not certain I know what it is, but I tend to believe that there are other ways out. Again, I talked last week about nuclear agro-industrial complexes in the context of resettling Palestinians somewhere else. Could that same concept be applied within Palestine to greatly increase the allowable population density? From the very beginning, including with the proposed United Nations partition line, which never was allowed to go into effect, one of the biggest problems has been that there is no obvious way to cut the territory into two chunks, that you wind up with enclaves and exclaves, patches of Jewish state territory surrounded by patches of Palestinian state territory, and vice versa. If you could just cut the territory in half and have the northern half of it be Palestine and the southern half be Israel, or vice versa, that would be much simpler, but you'd have to relocate millions of people, and there are other obstacles. We may, however, be at the point where people would be willing to consider that level of radical solution. I don't know. Again, one of the possible ways to help resolve the continuing problem over land is to build skyscraper or even megastructural cities, 100-story tall districts, which would incorporate things like urban vertical farming so they wouldn't be so dependent on arable land for their food supply. But whether that would be acceptable to anyone is very unclear. Now, I would do you, my listeners, and the world at large, a great disservice if I said, but all this is merely an example of the general principle I stated before, because we are talking about people's lives. We are talking about millions of people's lives, and very, very big questions. It is, however, still an example of the principle I was talking about before. Those who have the most power to act in a situation bear the greatest burden. And this is why I am so bitterly disappointed, both with nations, such as the United States and Russia in particular, again with the tanks and the jet aircraft and the atom bombs, because they have so much power to act, to ameliorate the conditions in the world, to move conditions in the world towards what people would accept as good, and just can't be bothered to do that, but also with the billionaires, with the extremely wealthy individuals, and with the people controlling the extremely wealthy business corporations, who have a comparable amount of power to make things happen in the world, and mostly aren't using it in any constructive way. Now, many of them, of course, are trying to use it in ways that benefit themselves, but they're mostly doing so without any great deal of vision. Carl Icahn and his Big Short 2.0 betting against shopping malls in the United States. What a small soul that man must have! He's in his 80s, and the only thing he's trying to do is amass more money by taking advantage of bad things that are happening to people. I bet he never considered the possibility that by investing in transit lines as public-private partnerships or what have you, he could turn those shopping malls, which are going downhill, into something more valuable for the community and make money out of it. No, that kind of thing would never occur to him. It would never occur to the kind of people who mostly become billionaires in this world. And that is why, for all the things there are to dislike about Elon Musk, I don't feel nearly as negatively toward him as some people do. Because clearly he has at least some modicum of vision. Clearly he has some idea that controlling enormous wealth gives him the ability to achieve things that are worth doing. Going into space. That's good. It truly is. Unfortunately, he seems to have very much fallen into the trap of believing his own publicity, and then decided that the publicity was all there was, I guess. It's difficult to put any other construction on his acquisition of Twitter and his behavior while in control of it. And I think the lesson for anyone who was lauding him to the heavens can be summed up in a quotation from the New Testament, the Christian scriptures. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. If the glory of God is the thing that is worth aspiring to, then it's true. All have fallen short. And you get up every day, and you go out there, and you do your best, and you still fall short. But that's the nature of anything worth aspiring to. Of course you're going to fall short of it. Of course you are. But when you fall short of something that's truly worth aspiring to, you still land somewhere that it's worth being. Well, after that prolonged meditation on the human condition, let's have some science. Here, at long last, is a segment that I recorded a few months ago about the Oklo phenomenon. If you've never heard of this, it's a fascinating story. The Oklo phenomenon refers to the scientific discovery in 1972 of the fact that 1.5 billion years ago, there were naturally occurring nuclear fission chain reactions on Earth. Now, this was possible then, and not now, because uranium-235 has a half-life less than 1 billion years, while uranium-238 has a half-life of about 5 billion years, which means that the proportion of uranium-235 to uranium-238 has been declining constantly throughout geological time. Now, with natural uranium as it is today, with 0.72% uranium-235, 7.2 grams of uranium-235 in a kilogram of uranium metal, or, if you prefer, one atom of uranium-235 in 140 atoms of the uranium element, you need very, very favorable conditions. You need extreme degree of purity, freedom from neutron-absorbing contaminants. And you need the uranium to be arranged in a particular geometric pattern. And you need as moderator either high-purity graphite, or possibly beryllium, or heavy water, none of which is to be found in nature. But of course we know that, with a little enrichment to increase the proportion of uranium-235, you can use light water, that is to say ordinary water, as moderator, and you can tolerate the presence of some neutron-absorbing structural materials. Many early light water reactors used stainless steel fuel cladding. So it had long been considered theoretically possible that in very rich deposits of uranium minerals, sometime in the geologic past, fission reactions could have occurred spontaneously. But it was assumed that, due to erosion and subduction and other such natural processes, it was unlikely we would ever find evidence of that. So let me read to you what Roger Naudet of the French nuclear laboratory at Saclay has to say about it. This is from an International Atomic Energy Agency publication. The story of the discovery is worth recalling. It began with the observation of a very slight isotopic anomaly in a natural uranium sample during a routine analysis at the Pierre Alat laboratory. Instead of 0.72% uranium-235 by weight, a sample of concentrate proved to have more like 0.71. There was concern that it had been adulterated with depleted uranium, either as a commercial fraud or to conceal some kind of clandestine uranium enrichment effort somewhere. A series of checks was carried out with a view to getting to the bottom of the matter. Then, when these had revealed other anomalous samples, a systematic program of analyses was started, the aim being to find the origin of what was thought to be some kind of artificial contamination. It was discovered that uranium ore with a concentration of fissionable nuclei below the normal had been received from Gabon. Gabon in Central Africa, former French colonial possession, where French mining interests had concessions, and inquiries revealed that it came from the northern end of the Oklo deposit. In addition, it was found that very large amounts of the depleted ore had already been supplied to the nuclear industry. Investigations revealed abnormal uranium in debris resulting from earlier exploration in the suspect area, and this was studied with great care. Fission products discovered in the ore pointed early to the origin of the anomaly. It was decided accordingly that the part of the deposit yielding anomalous uranium should be reserved for scientific research, and that exploitation in that zone should cease. In unworked regions of the deposit, exploration brought to light very large, still intact parts of the reaction sites. These have been studied in detail through boreholes, and a great deal of sampling has been done. The reaction sites consist of several compact bodies of uranium ore with a very high uranium concentration. Altogether, over 500 tons of uranium took part in the reactions, perhaps even more because more reaction sites have been discovered at the Oklo mine. The energy released must have amounted to almost 10 to the 11th power kilowatt hours. Again, several more of these things have been found in the same zone, so it's probably a great deal more than that. At some points, the integrated neutron flux exceeded 1.5 times 10 to the 21st neutrons per square centimeter, and samples with a uranium-235 concentration of as little as 0.29% have been found. That's about the concentration you would expect to find in the spent fuel of a CANDU reactor. That's a big deal. The state of preservation of the fossil nuclear reactions is exceptionally good, and the uranium has retained its configuration of the time so faithfully that reaction rate distribution across the formations can be interpreted in terms of neutron physics.
In fact, an entire episode in geological history can be studied thanks to the numerous tracers emanating from the nuclear reactions, beginning from the deposition of very high uranium concentrations some 1,800 million years ago, up to recent alterations. The relevance of nuclide migration at Oklo to the problem of geologic storage of radioactive waste was discussed, and it was indicated that in the Oklo geochemical environment during the past 1,800 million years, the fission product elements which migrated significantly were krypton, xenon, cesium, strontium, barium, molybdenum, and iodine. Two of the mobile elements are important from a nuclear waste storage point of view, strontium and cesium, and it has been indicated that the mobility of strontium was not sufficiently great to result in its total displacement. It is possible that the rate of dispersal was sufficiently low with respect to the half-life of strontium-90, 29 years, that little or no radioactive strontium escaped the reactor zone. Now, this is a really significant thing to understand, and let me interpret it for you a little because the somewhat dry scientific language doesn't bring it out so clearly. We're talking about a porous rock formation, saturated with water. If that hadn't been true, there would not have been enough neutron moderation, neutron slowing down, for the reaction to occur at all. And we know that the water moved in and out of this formation, because for the reaction to occur over a very long period of time, hundreds of thousands to millions of years, it is thought, there must have been some form of reactor control, essentially. And it appears that what happened is that when the reaction was well underway, it would heat up the rock, and this would force out some of the water, and the reaction would stop again. So water was coming into and out of this formation, in which was uranium, in which were the fission products. Now, by drilling for samples and doing a careful isotopic analysis, geologists are able to find where those fission products went. And what has been found is astonishing when you consider what is said about the dangers of nuclear waste. What is found from a situation which is not unlike having nuclear fuel pellets simply buried in an aquifer is that the inert final decay products of the fission fragments have not moved very far at all. Even the most mobile ones have moved perhaps tens of meters from the place where they were originally generated. In other words, a situation which represents your worst nightmare in terms of radioactive waste disposal, someone simply taking the spent fuel rods, digging a hole in the ground and burying them, the fission products did not move very far in the course of 1.8 billion years, which is, of course, far longer than the 300 years or so required for the fission products of most concern in radioactive waste disposal, strontium-90 and cesium-137, to decay to insignificant levels. It really does always boggle my mind how people say, the nuclear waste problem is unsolved! As I've said before, and I'll say again, that is an argument which is only ever made in bad faith. The Canadian method of immobilizing the fission products into a glassy material, which can then be cast into stainless steel containers and buried in a salt dome or clay or other water-impervious formation, was presented at the Geneva Conference of 1958, before civil nuclear power had fairly got underway, right, before the startup of Dresden or Bradwell or any of the other major civil nuclear power reactors that began to come online in the early 60s. That method of vitrification has proven, from every scientific and technical standpoint, completely satisfactory. But the people who campaign against atomic energy do everything in their power to stop it from being used so that they can go and say the problem of nuclear waste is not solved. As I've said many times, one of the reasons that I feel the need to advocate for atomic energy is not merely that I think it's really spiffy, although I do. Not merely because I see it as a very powerful way of addressing some of the major problems in our world today, although I certainly do, but because the people who oppose it are uniformly acting in bad faith. And the only way to explain what they do and the way they do it begins from the assumption that the use of atomic energy is fundamentally immoral. And I don't believe that. And I also don't believe that people who do believe that have the right to conceal their beliefs and instead lie to people in order to get the public to go along with them. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America. I'm